I am Platt on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. In 2013, Jovita Bydlowska published a critically acclaimed and best-selling memoir, Drunk Mom. The book was hailed and criticized for its honesty and candor. She explored her addiction to alcohol and being a new mother. I talked to her about the book and wished her well. As we read in her new book, Unshaming, a memoir of recovery, relapse, and what comes after, being a poster child for recovery put a lot of pressure on her. It was hard to cope, and when she was spiraling into alcoholism, it was difficult coming back up and out, especially with the expectations of readers and her growing son. The book is raw and often unsparing as Ms. Bydlowska explores the intricacies of shame, illustrating her with her own behavior and the feelings that accompany this harrowing journey. She works through a lot in the book and provides something helpful for the reader, whether it's a space to work through one's own expectations or how to have conversations with people who are contending with addiction issues. Jovita Bydlowska was born in Warsaw, Poland, and moved to Canada as a teenager. The second half of the book narrates two trips back to Poland that Jovita takes, and it's fascinating to see her reconciling her past and present, especially when she's in the throes of booze again. Visit jovitabydlowska.com for more. This new book is published by Signal, which is an imprint of McClelland and Stewart. We spoke a week and a half ago with Jovita joining me from Toronto. Please welcome back to the Platt Online program, Jovita Bydlowska. Ms. Bydlowska, good morning.
Hello, how are you?
Pretty good yourself.
I'm good, thank you.
The book opens with a bike accident, and you're seriously injured, and we see you in the hospital talking to the doctors, who ask you, obviously, what happened, and we see you sort of weave or embroider a story. The reputation of being the author of Drunk Mom 13 years ago, that has followed you, and I'm curious to know, how much has that weighed on you in a negative way, say?
Well, it certainly became something negative internally, in that when I started to relapse, I believed myself to be sort of held up as an example of maybe not necessarily sobriety, but recovery, because Drunk Mom ends on a sort of a positive note, and I have spoken publicly about recovery, and obviously when I published the book, I was sober, etc. So what that story at the beginning of Unshaming really illustrates is the break between the sort of double life that I'm having, because I'm having an accident, but I believe internally, whether that's true or not, it doesn't matter, but I believe that people think that I'm this, sober, together person, and meanwhile, I'm getting into accidents, etc., that are caused by drinking, so... Yeah.
It shows really how much shame there is, and mm-hmm. how you have to work through that, and that's why the book is called Unshaming, because this is a process that you're working through. In the book, you talk about how that memoir was received, and we talked 13 years ago. Mm-hmm. It was a bestseller, but you also talk in the book about how there were a lot of things that were said in 2013 that would probably hit differently in 2026.
Yeah.
Certain reviews read cringy now,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to then.
Yeah, I mean, what's changed? Is that what you're asking? I mean, even let's just take addiction, for example. So in 2013, 13 years ago, it was, it was a very shameful thing. I don't know if you remember, but celebrities were always going away for exhaustion and things like that. So, and of course, Amy Winehouse had come out with rehab songs. So it was sort of in our zeitgeist, if you will, but it was still very much like an embarrassing thing. Like, we had all those tabloids, like Paris Hilton making fun of, Lindsay Lohan, Britney Spears, and Anna Nicole Smith, who was dying right in front of our eyes. Amy Winehouse was dying. But it was not a good place to come out with a story talking about how not only addiction, but also one sort of combined with the most terrible events in human existence, childbirth and motherhood. And I publicly announced both situations occurring at the same time. So that was you know, for that reason, it was not necessarily received. I mean, there was a lot of good feedback and good reaction as well. But the negative one certainly played into that, that stigma that we had around addiction. And I think things are different now in that, you know, even let's go back to celebrities. We pretty much know who is sober, who's not, because they tell us, and they tell us proudly.
Yeah.
And, you know, going to rehab, it's not necessarily a badge of honor, but it's a rite of passage for many celebrities and for regular people as well. And, you know, we talk about mental health openly. Like, I used to teach at university, and my students would have academic accommodations due to, you know, anxiety to do public speaking. So all these things were not around during the drunk mom years. So, yeah.
In the book, you talk about image issues that you've had to contend with throughout your life, or especially early on. You know, you write about genetics, your looks, how they made some things easier as you went through life. But it also screwed up your relationship with food, didn't it? I mean, you'd forgo food, you'd restrict it, you'd binge. That's another source of shame, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think body shame is very common for women, and I think we live in a very interesting time now where it's becoming really prevalent amongst men. So I'm not saying this is an extension for myself, but something that I'm even recently with this whole look smack thing, and like I have a 17-year-old, my son's 17 now, and there's a lot of talk about gyms and appearance, and so it's funny because, I mean, not funny at all, but like what I'm talking about is something that was probably more specific to women and to girls, which was, you know, you had to look a certain way, or you believed yourself that you had to, and you had to restrict food, and, you know, everything was appearance-based. And now, interestingly enough, this is affecting men and boys as well. So I think I don't know if you've watched the Golden Globes or whatever. There were a bunch of, again, back to celebrities, because I feel like they really are sort of a touchstone for what's going on with trends. But
yeah.
Suddenly everyone's looking skinny again, right? I saw some pictures. I forget which celebrity it was who, like, lost weight, gained weight, lost weight again. Oh my God, here we are again. But I'm certainly both a victim and probably a character, right? Because I don't know if I'm even joking when I say that I'm shallow and that I judge things and people by appearances. We all do submit to it. So I don't really know what, I mean, I guess it's like a healthy balance.
Yeah. I went back to listen to our interview from 13 years ago, and one of the things I asked you was how the book might be received by your son. And in the book, I found it interesting. Some teachers would tell him that they'd read it. How did that affect him?
Not at all. I mean, I don't know if it's disappointing or if it's like, he's had a unique position. He grew up with not just one, but two writers.
Right.
Yeah, well, Drunk Mom, there have been, I think, I don't know, 7 books published by his dad or me. And I went into fiction. So he's very much used to that sort of, not attention, but scrutiny of, you know, what his parents do for a living a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But we have had many conversations about addiction, obviously. And this was a lot more intentional in terms of, like, what I wanted to say in it and how I wanted to sort of position my relationship with my son. It's interesting. I'm working on a book on friends of addicts.
Mm-hmm.
Not me, but it will be about people, not around me, other people. So I did ask him recently how he felt about my addiction, what it was like to grow up with it, and he said that obviously was very hard for many reasons. But the one thing he really appreciated was that we always were open about it and could talk about it. Now, you could say that that's a good and maybe normal, but too much, a situation that's not normal. But at the same time, I'm a little bit less worried that he will have a similar issue that I did, which is, you know, hiding and keeping it secret. I don't know. We'll try to make it digestible.
Yeah. One of the things I asked you then was, because he was much younger then, like he was just 3 or 4 at the time, was when he would know about, you know, all of this and the book, not just the book, but all of this. And there's a painful sequence in the book, Unshaming, where there's some distance between you. He doesn't trust you because of the relapse.
Yeah.
And it's so hard to read. This section where where you're talking and then he just smirks at you and makes it, makes some sort of comment. And it obviously hurts as a mom, doesn't it? And I don't know, I guess I foresaw that for 13 years ago, and I just, in reading that in Unshaming, I felt bad.
I mean, also he's a teenager, right? So he would be smirking at things anyway.
He'd be smirking at anything.
But, in that moment, again, I often worry if we, put too much emphasis on all these talks because, but it's hard to say. I can tell you I wasn't that bad compared to other addict parents who, fall down and break their bones and, whatever it is, right? It doesn't matter. This is just my own experience. So we did always talk about it. We did put a lot of emphasis on it. It is possible that he may be overreacting or that he's extra sensitive to things and in that section in particular, I think I say to him, but I have mental illness, and he kind of rolls his eyes at it or smirks. And it was one of the very few times where I actually tried to manipulate situation by making him feel sorry for myself because I was feeling sorry for myself. So, it's none of it is honest or authentic. This is not a conversation. I think we both react in a dramatic way because that's what it deserved. It was a good conversation. So, people, even the addiction, the wisdom is that I'm learning all the time, and it's just the wisdom sort of that, people who are around me, meaning my parents, was also kind of learning with me. So I feel like, I can't remember what we talked about exactly, but I remember in 2013, I gave a lot of interviews where I think I had to share, and I kind of got this thing, and I had some kind of wisdom, and 13 years later, I'm like, I don't know anything. All I know is that we certainly are obsessed a little bit with happy endings, and it's an interesting thing to explore what happens after the happy ending, because life isn't happy ending. Things go on, and
That's what the book is. Why the book is so readable and. Mm-hmm. Because I found that the candor that you write with in the book is really a gift for the reader, because we see how hard recovery is, that it's not one straight line, that, there are challenges along the way, there are relapses for some people, and then the shame attached with addiction, mental illness. I guess I wondered, as I read the book, Jovita, how important it is for us, people who are around people who are addicted, to recognize and understand the shame in others, because that's hard for a lot of us to do, but it's incredibly affecting for the person who is addicted.
Mm-hmm. I mean, originally this book was not even supposed to be about addiction. So if I wanted to go back, I really wanted to write a book about shame, because it was something that people talked to me about a lot, sort of in relation with addiction. So I just to write a nonfiction investigative journalism sort of book on shame, and interviewing philosophers. There's a lot of research in my book, which is mostly in footnotes, and that's kind of the original draft of the first Unshaming, I guess. And then the reason why I use my example, and specifically example of addiction, is because I was trying to think of okay, if I'm going to write a book about shame, I should have some expertise on it, and what is my expertise? And it's that one of addiction. So I don't want to have a message where it's addicts particularly, or whatever you want to call it, need some special treatment. I think we have our shame and completely internalized, and they have to stop drinking, or you can't stop gambling, or whatever your fixations. I mean, people have shame around. Right, we have this phrase, germ spilling or brain rot, right? People do feel some sort of way about it. So I think being more aware of each other's struggles in that way. It's kind of, you know, what I mean, it's not that I would like to have that to happen, but I would like for that message to be conveyed more, and because I think that leads to empathy. So similarly, like, I mean, when I do see people, especially in Toronto, there's a lot of unhoused folks, like, especially since, you know, the pandemic, and I do every time I walk by someone, and, you know, my first instinct is to judge or to, you know, withdraw or even, like, discuss, like, I think this between me and this person, it could be just, like, you know, one shot of vodka, like, obviously not literally, but I'm like, this is really the only barrier between us is that. And so it's between anybody else, because there are people who have become addicted in a more educational way over time, not because of trauma or necessarily because they just were genetically predisposed. Like,
yeah.
So we're all pretty close to it. Empathy goes a long way, I think.
Indeed. I think that's one of the great lessons of the book, whether one's an addict or not, empathy is something that we all could use in our lives, and we should convey that to other people. There's nothing wrong with doing that. You write in the book about AA, about the criticism that it gets, but how helpful it's been for you. What is it like when it stopped working for you in terms of not being sober? Because you would still attend, wouldn't you? And it would be a performance in a way, right?
I don't know if I said this. You said that, but that's the word for it. It's where you, where you pretend to be somebody else that you're not. My personal beef, I guess, or whatever it is, with AA has to do with my own, my personality, whatever I need specifically. I really start to do it hard, you know, in environments of 12-step group where it's very connected. It's this very, but, I mean, there's a lot of, there's original AA was sort of begun by Oxford Christian Group. So it has a lot of, which didn't really agree with me, but I just found it to be one more place of shame.
Yeah.
Because, again, I kept relapsing and I didn't have those giant milestones of sobriety, because there's a lot of celebration of sobriety, whether it's 24 hours or 6 months or 30 years, and I just felt like less than. It was just one more place where inadequate, and I was supposed to be the place of my sort of salvation and safety. So for me, it was not really productive in that way. But I know most people go to, they go to their first meeting and then they stay sober for the rest of their life. So everybody has a different journey. I found a lot more solid and a lot more, useless in doing any meetings. I'm like, maybe it's literally, me being more of an introvert than some people need that, right? People have energy.
Yeah. You talk about how the spiritualism or even the religion around AA, how that was that you were able to find other AA meetings that were not.
There's agnostic AA is pretty developed. There are about 700 meetings on Zoom, as far as I know, and there's sort of 24/7. And I'm not a person for that. There's all kinds of recovery now, and especially now we have so many. I've lost track because businesses are like soberish, harm reduction or drinking or whatever it is, and then I've been so drilled into my head that the only way to recover is to connecting with other people. That even the thing is very popular, she's not buying connection, right? So we hear it over and over. But then I've met people who have the COVID in the woods, alone, it's connected with them.
Yeah, I guess that's the thing that I got out of the book, is that if it works for one person, it might not work for me or anybody else, right?
Yeah.
And we need to recognize that it doesn't also happen quickly.
Yeah, And I think that sort of almost goes back to the happy ending. Mm. You know, like very simple explanation and solution. But we're all grown ups. Like, we know that that's not usually the case. So, but I mean, I think that it should be if it works for people, it's great. If it doesn't, there's other things.
So you write about your son, you write about your ex-husband, you write about the boyfriend, you write about yourself, obviously. But one of the more fascinating characters in the book is Clifford, the dog, because he obviously brings out something in you, and you readily admit that he was so much for your son as he was for you, more for you than your son, I should say. And he brings something out in you. The dog teaches you a lot, doesn't he?
Yeah, no, he was certainly... I mean, every single platitude that you ever hear about dogs, you know, they teach you unconditional love, and they don't want anything from you. They just want to, you know, get food and love you. That's really all they want, right? It's like, it's so pure, and I know, and I have heard this from people who have said, well, didn't do this for you, the dog did, and I'm, all I'm going to say is just, I was just at the right time at the right place or something to me is like a folk meal, but this creature that the sacred could, like, you know, I talk about saying the basic prayer with the word please. It's not a religious prayer, it's just really pleading to just get another day of sobriety or grace, or whatever you want to call it, and I do it with little puppy all along, and, you know, because I don't have less me in physical way, but more so in emotional, that I just really felt this, like, end of, you know, this creature that's allowing me to, I don't know, be myself, be around it, and I mean, I like, I understand a lot of people who, like, it's going to have 62 hours.
Jovita, do you, in thinking about writing, because you've been awfully candid, not just in this book, but in Drunk Mom and other writing that you've done, it's such a burden and a source of connection for you in a way, isn't it? I mean, I wonder, as the writer, and having had to live this life as you have, I mean, do you regret being as candid as you have been?
No, because I don't have a lot of fear. I don't have a lot of shame. I feel very free. I'm not wealthy in a material sense, but I'm really... I don't know if it's... I really feel as authentically as I can, and I'm very lucky, very blessed to have... in my life right now, and have had a lot of forgiveness. Yeah, I mean, I've been pretty, like, it's one of those things, right? Like, if you don't lie, then you never have to worry about telling the truth. So right. I feel like I'm living in my truth. Now, did it have to be public? Not at all, but I also happen to be born a writer. So that's what I do with what I have. And I do write fiction. That's sort of my biggest first love, is writing fiction and putting a lot of whatever other emotions into those stories. And so I don't particular regrets. I mean, listen, if the predictions from 13 years ago that my son would disown me and hate me and turn out, I'm sure I probably would have somehow made a mistake. Yeah, and maybe I'd prefer, but I had a weird. Sort of, yeah. I guess I don't know. I have a lot of hope too.
I was left with a lot of hope having finished the book the other night, and I don't know if it's right for me to say, but I mean, I guess I was just rooting for you throughout the book and now after the book, I guess.
Thank you.
You still hear from a lot of readers of Drunk Mom?
I do, yeah. Oh, that's another, like, I always forget that. So that's a very surprising thing. So a couple of things happened with drunk mom. So it didn't, you know, it didn't sort of explode and then disappear. It kind of, like, it's still getting printed. It's still getting bought. It's been taught in a couple of universities. It's, like, all kinds of things are happening with it. And there's a movie they made. It's been shot and hopefully will be. If it's not this year, then... No, I said I'm hoping it will be. But I'm saying the biggest and most important thing that's happened is that I do hear from readers, less so these days.
Mm-hmm.
Once a month, you know, not once a month, but monthly I get a couple of messages.
Yeah.
A lot of them are really from fun. The one that's probably, like, most memorable is a couple of years ago I heard from a young woman who lost both parents to addiction, which within a very short period of time, and she said someone gave her a drunk mom after her mom passed, and she said it was like, I understand what my mom was saying to me. You know, yeah, it was beautiful. Like,
yeah. Yeah, you know, I have to say there's a moment in the book where, in Unshaming, where I had to laugh out loud, where you're in a Zoom, and someone else in the Zoom, I guess, sends you a private message asking if you've written anything else other than Drunk Mom, and then you send a link, but then the link accidentally gets sent to the whole group, and
yeah.
it's just a funny moment in terms of our
Zoom.
I congratulations on this book, Yuvita.
Thank you so much.
I enjoyed reading it, and I enjoyed the conversation today.
Thank you so much, Joe. Thank you.
All the best.
You too.
The website for more is at yuvitabidlovska.com. The book is called Unshaming, a memoir of recovery, relapse, and what comes after. It's published by Signal, which is an imprint of McClelland and Stewart. Its author, Yuvita Bidlovska, joined me on the line from Toronto. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planta.